Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian Mines, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you deeply for inviting me here to witness this. I had used the word the other day, awesome. And believe me, you are awesome. But what really impresses me about this roundup is that outside by the pool. That sight out there is indelibly etched in my mind. Never had I seen anything so complete as that scene out there by the pool. I mean, when I look at Bill and look at Bob and I see what they've done, it's all out there. The how, the when, the where. When I see the woman walking around pregnant and the newborn and the kids growing up and the old timers, it's all there. The whole fellowship. And I want to thank you, if for nothing else, for that scene in my mind. And it's been a real roller coaster this weekend, an emotional roller coaster, sitting there, hearing the different messages from the different speakers. And to hear the words of the message of AA. And with your permission, ladies and gentlemen, I would like the honor of giving a big hug, a big Gopher State roundup hug to our silent speaker, Patty, for showing us the words of AA. So with your permission. My name is Brian, ladies and gentlemen. I'm an alcoholic and I come from New York on the Upper East Side. And it's I'm first generation. There's an area of mostly European immigrants, hard workers, hard drinkers. And I don't remember the first time I picked up a drink, but I do remember the first time I had a blackout, the first time I pulled a blank. Somehow, looking back over my life, I seem to be able to remember more things about growing up than I can about being grown up. I seem to be able to remember with pinpoint accuracy certain things that happened to me as a boy much more clearly than I can of many things that happened to me as a man. And I was about 13 years old. A friend of mine, Johnny, and I, we had some money in our pocket from hustling papers the night before in the saloons. And we went way in the back of a vacant building and we dug out one of the local winos to go get us three bottles of Sneaky Pete. And I remember this man as one of the most handsomest men I could ever remember. He stood about 6'2". He had jet black curly hair, big blue eyes. The most he could have been was anywhere from 26 to 30 years old. And here he was, an old, young, dirty man. He was a wino. He was a bum. I come from a work ethnic background, ladies and gentlemen, and the only requirement for being a man was a desire to work. As long as you had a desire to work, you could beat the wife, beat the kids, beat the system. You could do anything you want. As long as you had a desire and you worked. And he broke the cardinal rule, this whole little pack of winos broke the cardinal rules. They no longer worked. So they were ostracized to the vacant buildings and the vacant lots and the benches in the along the East River. And he went and he brought back three pints and he got his pint and he scurried back off into the building. And Johnny and I, we went down to the next block in the back of the vacant lots where they had a lean-to built. And I cracked my pint and Johnny cracked his and we started drinking and we're laughing and giggling and body punching and arm wrestling. We finished the pint. We started walking up the street, and I remember walking up, bumping into the people, you know. It's the first experience I had with what they call beer muscles. You know, really. And we went, we dug out the window to go get us three more pints. And I remember it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon of a Saturday when I cracked that second pint in the back of the vacant lots. And the next thing I knew, I come out of a blackout. My mother had my head over the kitchen tubs. I was throwing all this booze into all this wine into the tubs, and my two brothers had been leaning over, punching the hell out of me, screaming at me, where had I been? Because the neighbors came in and told my mother that day that her son was drunk, staggering all over the neighborhood, and my brothers were out, and my friends were out, and the neighbors were out, scouring the whole neighborhood, and they didn't find me until 11 o'clock at night. And my brothers were screaming at me, where had I been? And I just didn't know. I mean, one minute was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, here was 11 o'clock at night, and I just didn't know. And it puzzled me. Now, up until the age of 13, I had been drunk many a time. But this was the first time I pulled a blank. And it frightened me. Not only did it excite me, but it frightened me. I mean, it excited me because it was like one of these Back to the Future things, you know? And it frightened me because you didn't know how, when, or where. You know, you just didn't know. And it bothered me. And a couple of days later, I'm walking up the neighborhood, and one of these big guys come walking down, and I stopped. And I started to explain to him what had happened. And I remember he was a big, tall guy. He had his hands in his hip. He was kind of rocking back and forth, smiling at me, looking down, laughing. And when I was finished, he turned around and he said, "Kid, were you drinking?" And I said, yeah, I was drinking. He said, "Were you drunk?" I said, yeah, I was drunk. And he just leaned back. He rocked back. He gave me this big, expansive shrug, a smile. He tousled my hair, walked around me, and kept walking. All my life, it seemed that I had seen that shrug, this alcoholic shrug. I mean, I was born and raised with it. I'd walk into the bar, and there wouldn't be a soul in the bar. And I'd say, "Where the hell is everybody?" They say, "Oh, they're out looking for Joe's car. He doesn't know where he parked it last night." They'd be going up and down around their neighborhood looking for it. And somebody would say, "Was Joe drinking last night?" They say, "Yeah." "Was Joe drunk last night?" They say, "Yeah." They just shrugged. They wouldn't say anything. They just shrugged. I'd walk into the bar. They say, "Mary left. She just left. She's hysterical. She's going crazy. She doesn't know where she left the children. She's going crazy." And somebody would say, "Is Mary drinking?" They say, "Yeah." "Is Mary drunk?" They say, "Yeah." And they just shrugged. Nobody ever explained the shrug, ladies and gentlemen. It was like a blanket endorsement. They just shrugged. When I was a kid, I broke into the church rectory to rob some baptismal papers, because you had to be 16 to get in the pool room. I was 14. I forged my papers to get in the pool room. And when I was 16, I used these papers to get my seaman's paper. And at 17, I just turned 17, I ran away from home and I went to sea. And the shrug followed me. No matter where I went, the shrug was there. It was like some kind of international voodoo. It was like juju, no matter where I went. My first trip, I was in a nightclub in Singapore, and I gotten into a fight, and I got pretty bad cut up and pretty bad beat up. And the cops came, and they took me to the hospital where they stitched me up, and then they took me and they threw me in a tank, and they had me in a tank for 3 days. And in those days, Singapore was still a British Crown colony. So 3 days later, when they called me out, they took me out, they put me in the docket. The magistrate was sitting up there, the English judge, and he had a big white curly wig on, a long black flowing robe. And representing me was the American consulate, and the captain was there. And when he called me out, I looked like one of these punk rockers or wrestlers of today. Half of the head was shaved like a mohawk and stitched up, and the other part of the hair was standing straight up, all discolored from peroxide material. My face was a mess, and the shirt was all blood and stuck to the stitches, and I was a mess. And I was standing there in the docket, and I remember the magistrate leaning over saying to the American consulate, he said, "Was the bloke drinking?" And the American consul leaned over to me, he said, "Were you drinking?" And I leaned over there and I looked at the American consul right in the eye, one eyeball to eyeball, one American to another. And I said to him, "Was I drinking?" I said, "Of course I was drinking." I said, "I hope you don't think I look like this sober, do you?" I said, "What the hell kind of an American do you think I am anyway?" I said, "Of course I was drinking. I was drinking. They were drinking. We're all drunk." And he turned around, he looked up at the magistrate. He said, "Yes, your magistrate, the bloke was drinking." And the judge leaned back. He went like this there. The American counselor went like that. The captain went like that. I went like that. And ladies and gentlemen, that's the story of my life. It's just one shrug after another. Ladies and gentlemen, that's where alcohol took me. It reduced me and my life to a human shrug. They would say, "The ship sailed for Panama last night. Is Brian aboard? Is Brian coming home tonight? Does Brian have any money left? Is Brian going to have to do time? Whatever happened to that nice girl he was going with?" And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. That's it in a nutshell. About 1969, I come out of a blackout, and I was standing up, I had a phone in my hand, I was weaving back and forth, in and out of the blackout, and I was listening to this voice saying, "Take it easy, Brian, take it easy. Give us your address and we'll send a couple of men over to talk to you." And I couldn't figure out who this guy was. I'm going to send a couple of men over to talk to me. So I kept throwing words out, hoping maybe he'd bite and I could fill in around a sentence to figure out who the guy was. And he kept saying, "Take it easy, Brian. Give us your address. I'll send a couple of men over to talk to you." Finally, I said, "What do you mean send a couple of men over to talk to me?" I said, "Who the hell are you anyway?" He says, "I'm so-and-so from Intergroup." Now, if you never heard the word Intergroup before, you must admit it sounds like some kind of a communist word, you know? I said, "Intergroup?" I said, "What the hell are you talking about, Intergroup?" I said, "Who the hell are you anyway?" He says, "I'm so-and-so from Intergroup, Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Intergroup, Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "How the hell did you get my number?" He said, "You just called us up." I said, "I called you up. What the hell did I call you up for?" He said, "Look, Brian, take it easy. Give it your address. I'll send a couple of men." I said, "Look, don't you be sending anybody over here starting trouble. I'll give you something. I'll give you a punch in the face. That's what I'll give you." I hung up the phone, I sat in the bed, and I put my head in my hands, and the sweat just started pouring out of me. And my mind raced back and forth, and I was trying to think,
What in God's name did I do this time that Intergroup would be after me? Because the only thing I knew about Intergroup was the old movies with Jimmy Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. And in those movies, when Intergroup was after you, it meant one thing. You know? So I got up and I put the light out, and I crept up against the door, and I tried to peek out the little keyhole. And I'm looking, thinking maybe I'll hear keys, rattling of keys, or footsteps in the hallway. And then I crept across the floor, and I leaned up against the window, and I pulled the shade back, and I searched out the doorways across the street, thinking maybe I'd see an Intergroup guy over there, you know, smoking, looking up at me. Well, what the hell did I know? About 1970, I come out of another block, and I'm talking to this voice on the phone again. And the guy told me where the meeting was. And the meeting was the old Butterfield Group in New York on 72nd Street, right off 2nd Avenue. And I went. And the only thing I heard at that meeting was, stay out of one bar at a time. Now, I'm sure in my rummy mind what the man said was stay away from one drink at a time. But the way I heard it was stay away from one bar at a time. And I walked out. I walked up to 72nd Street and 3rd Avenue. And from 72nd Street and 3rd Avenue, I walked all the way up to 93rd Street and 3rd Avenue, passing all these saloons. Nothing happened. I walk in one bar. I'm at the bar. I ordered up my usual sobering up drink, which was a large club soda with a big chunk of lemon. And I'm standing at the bar, and next thing I felt my head starting to wind up, and I felt my body trembling, and I went into a fit. And when I come out of the fit, I was in an ambulance with a friend of mine, Jackie, and his big attendant. He was kneeling on top of me, and I didn't know where I was, and he was trying to ram something in my mouth, and I didn't know, and I rolled over, and I got on top of him. I started beating the shit out of him. He started screaming to the ambulance driver to stop the ambulance. The ambulance came to a screech and rolled. The door flew open. I took off. I hit the deck running. I took off. Jackie hit the deck running. He's chasing me, and I ran up this block, and Jackie chased me. I ran down this block, and Jackie chased me, and I run into the bar. I'm huffing and puffing at the bar. Jackie comes running in. He's huffing and puffing at the bar. I grabbed him. I said, what happened? God damn it, what happened? What was all that about? He says, I don't know. He says, everything was all right. You come into the bar. He said, next thing you went into some kind of a fit. Now, the only thing I could attribute that fit to was this Intergroup stuff. You know? I remember that they told me to stay out of one bar at a time. I passed all those bars. Nothing happened to me. I go in one stinking bar and I wake up in an ambulance. I figured, oh, man. I said to Jackie, no wonder these people are anonymous. I mean, they could kill you in broad daylight and never leave a fingerprint. I said, oh, man. I said with this Intergroup stuff, Jackie, you know. I said, they had one crack at me. They goddamn near killed me. I said, that's it, you know. Well, in 1969, I was on a ship. We were about three days out of the Suez Canal, and I had been drinking. I had booze stashed all over the ship that I robbed out of the hole, and I was on a drunk, and the storm came up. And I thought somehow, in my paranoid mind, I thought the storm was there for me, and when the storm hit, I opened the door with a bottle in my hand, and I stepped out into the deck and spitting at the storm and cursing and laughing and crying and peeing against it and defying it, and it's knocking me all over the place. The end result was it busted my shoulder. I got a broken shoulder. They wanted to take me off in Alexandria. I wouldn't get off. I rode the ship to Naples, where they took me off, and they had me in the hospital for 3 days. And then they put me in a body cast with a big bar out of here, and my arm was out like this here. And I hadn't drank now in about a week or 2 weeks. Excuse me. And they took me to Rome to the airport, and I had a couple of hours to go before the plane took off, and I took the agent out, so all right, I'll just hang around. I'm sitting there, and I figured, oh, I might as well get a couple of postcards and mail them to the boys in the bar, have a couple of drinks, what the hell. And I ordered a little cappuccino, a little Fundador brandy. I start writing the notes. And the next thing I know, I'm on the plane. The plane gets to New York. I'm all drunk. I'm coming off the plane. I was like a drunken runaway construction boom. Going down there, and everybody ducking. Here I'm banging into walls, people screaming. By 1970, we're 5 days out of Seattle bound for Yokohama. And I'm drunk. I got booze all stashed all over the ship where I robbed it out of the cargo hold. And another storm comes up, and I figured the storm was there for me. And there I go out, slamming the door open with the bottle, spitting at it, peeing against it, kicking, fighting, laughing, crying. And the wave came along, picked me up, slammed me against the housing, and shattered the lower part of my back. So for the rest of the trip, I rode on my belly to Yokohama, where they took me off, and they had me in the hospital for 16 days where they operated on me. And I hadn't drank now in about 3 weeks. And they take me out to Tokyo to the airport, and I had a couple of hours to go. And I told the agent, don't worry about it, I'll get down on a flight myself. And I figured, well, I might as well get a couple of postcards and mail it to the boys and have a little hot sake, you know, what the hell. Then I wrote the postcard. Next thing I'm on the plane, I'm drinking. I'm all drunk. I passed out in the seat. I woke up. There was a whole puddle of blood there from where the drain came out. And they had me in the back, and they're wiping me clean. They had a bar of Kotex, and they're packing me with Kotex. And I was a mess, you know. And I figured, the hell with this stuff going to sea. It seems like every time I went to sea now, there was a whole school of angry Moby Dicks out there waiting for me, you know. Seems like they had nothing against Captain Ahab. It was me that they didn't like. And I figured, oh, the hell with that. So I went back to work in the tunnels. The two jobs mostly I did all my life was Sandhagen. For those of you who don't know, that's a tunnel worker, compressed air worker, the work underneath the water in the compression chambers. And so I went back to work Sandhagen. And I was working on a job on the west side. I was the dynamiter on a job, and I was on a drunk. And I was passed out in my room. And it was big banging and kicking at the door and banging and kicking at the door. And the shop steward saying, "I'll open up the door, Brian, open up, I'll kick it in. God damn it, open up the door." I finally got up and I opened up the door. He walked in, he said, "Phew, what a stink." What the hell? He went over and he opened the drapes and pulled up the shades and opened the windows, and the place was a mess. He said, "Jesus, what the hell are you doing?" He said, "When the hell are you coming back to work?" I said, "What are you making a big stink about?" I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "How long do you think you've been on this drunk?" And I just vaguely remember sort of going in and out, coming and going some people, and I said, "I don't know, about 2 weeks." He said, "No, you've been on this drunk 6 weeks." And I was in the grip of the grape this time 6 weeks. And I just said, "Jesus, 6 weeks." He said, "When are you coming back to work?" He said, "We can't keep covering you on a job. When are you coming back?" I said, "What's today?" He said, "Today's Wednesday." I said, "All right." I said, "Look, you tell him I'll be back Monday morning." He said, "Look, Brian, can I go back and tell him you'll be back to work Monday?" I said, "You can take book on it. I'll be there." And all I ever needed all my life was to come off a drunk, was a quiet place, a toilet, water, and that was it. And I just laid dead, and I go through the shakes and the whips and the jingles and the horrors and whatever I had to do. Usually I could bail out in 3 days. And Monday morning, indeed, I come out and I went to work. They called for the dynamite at 9 o'clock. I loaded up, I don't know how many sticks of dynamite, hundreds of thousands, you know. And it went up to the heading. And when you go up to the heading in the tunnel with the dynamite, all the electricity is shut off and all the lights are moved back for fear of a spark that may set off the charge. And everything is, the loading of the dynamite is done by headlights and flashlights and air lights. So it's all dark and eerie, and so they're up there, they're loading it, and I went into a convulsion. And they're all screaming, they didn't know what the hell is happening. They turned around, they called out. They called out for an ambulance, and "What the hell is going on? What's going on? Where is he? He's over there." I said, "No," and I'm flopping around and saying, "No, he's over here, there he is, watch out. You're standing on him." I'm flopping all over the tunnel there. They called out, and they called for the ambulance, and the ambulance heard about the dynamite. There was a lot of bombings going on there in New York, and they called the police, and the police called the bomb squad, and the mayor was there. When I come out, they had the SWAT team with binoculars and baseball bats and all that, and I come out, I'm shaking like a leaf. And if you're a compressed air worker, they won't allow you to work in the tunnels if you're an epileptic. They were claiming I was an epileptic, and I had an epileptic seizure. And they wouldn't allow me to go back to work until I went to Lenox Hill Hospital and went through a whole series of epilepsy tests, which I did. I went through all these different tests. And a couple of days later, I'm sitting outside the neurosurgeon's office waiting to be called in. And all of a sudden, he opened the door. He leaned down. He said, "Mr. Mines?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, you know, he waved in. And as I walked into his office, I stopped and I took a deep breath. And I walked into his office. He's sitting there, and he had all the graphs and charts and photographs in front of him. And he said, "Well, Mr. Mines, everything here looks pretty negative." And I heard the word negative, and I let my breath out just a little bit. And I said, "Well, what do you mean by negative?" And he said, "Well, things look pretty good here." And I let my breath out just a little bit more. I said, "Do you mean to say I'm not an epileptic?" He said, "No, no, no, you're not an epileptic, you're an alcoholic." I said, "Yeah, yeah, 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 yeah." I said, "I'm not an epileptic, right?" He said, "No, you're an alcoholic." I said, "Then I didn't have an epileptic fit in the tunnel." He said, "No, you had an alcoholic seizure." I said, "Oh, thank God." I leaned over, I grabbed him, I started hugging him. I mean, I couldn't care less about being an alcoholic. What the hell would I care about being an alcoholic? As far as I'm concerned, any man worth the salt was an alcoholic. So I had him put it in writing. I went back to the job, and there was the safety engineer. I threw it on the desk of the safety engineer. I said, "Here, I'm an alky, not an epi." He said, "Oh." He said, "Good for you, you're an alcoholic." I said, "Yeah." He said, "No kidding, so am I." I said, "No kidding." He said, "Yeah, you're going back to work?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You want a drink?" I said, "Yeah." He pulled out the door, pulled out the bottle, handed me the bottle. I started swinging, he started swinging. And I went back to work, and life was good. Life was good. They couldn't fire me because I wasn't an epileptic. I just found a newfound friend who was an alcoholic with a bottle tucked away. I mean, I couldn't care less. But I was really concerned about the fits, the alcoholic fits. I mean, I was having convulsions now in subway platforms, in the middle of the streets, and you never knew where it was going to hit. And I was really shaken by it. I was really taking their knees out from under me. And a friend of mine, Joe, who happened to wind up being my sponsor, Joe and I, we were born and raised together, went to sea together, played the street together, and now we're working the tunnels together. And he was sober in AA for 7 years. And Joe come up to the apartment, he had heard the trouble I was in, and he said, "Look, Brian, why don't you attend a couple of AA meetings with me?" And I was really concerned about the convulsions, and I went. And at the second meeting, I heard the speaker guarantee that if you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk. He guaranteed that if you stay away from one drink one day at a time, it's impossible to get drunk. He guaranteed if you don't pick up that first drink, you can't get drunk. Afterward, the meeting broke up, and I made a beeline for the stairs. Everybody stopped, and they started to say to Our Father. And I was shocked. And I searched out the crowd, and there was Joe. And he was kind of leaning back, holding his two fingers with his eyes hooded, rocking on his heels, saying to Our Father. And I looked at Joe, and I said to myself, "Ah, Joe, Joe. What did they do to you, Joe? You know? I mean, here was a guy, I mean, I drank and we fought together, and here he is now rocking to Jesus and psalm singing with the best of them." You know, I said, "Oh, man." Afterward, we went for coffee. We're about two blocks away from the church. And I'm sitting there, and I said, "Look, Joe." And I leaned over. I said, "Just between you and me, Joe. Just between you and me. This has nothing to do with those people back there." I said, "Joe, did you understand that guy up there when he said, if you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk? Did you really understand what he said?" And Joe looked at me. He said, "Sure, yeah, I understand it." I said, Joe, deep down in the caverns of your bowels, Joe, did you really understand what that guy said? If you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk?" And Joe says, yeah, I understand it. I said, "Joe, if you understand it, what the hell are you doing there for 7 years? I said, this is my second meeting, and I understand it." I said, "Of course he's guaranteeing you that you can't get drunk if you don't pick up the first drink. Joe, that's the same thing as me guaranteeing you if you don't leave the house tomorrow, you won't get run over by a bus. Can't you see, Joe, it's happy horseshit time, man? You're being bullshitted, man. Joe, what's wrong with you?" And he said, "Look, Brian, please, why don't you try 90 days, 90 meetings? Why don't you take this here meeting book and make some meetings?" I said, Joe, maybe you don't mind sitting there in the front row, humped over, squinting up the speaker like some kind of AA Quasimodo, slurping for sobriety. I said, "Joe, sucking around people's ankles isn't my idea of what being a man is all about. You got to get up there, head into the storm, Joe. What's the matter with you, boy?" Just then, the bells started ringing from the church, and I broke out laughing. I said, "Joe, you better get up there. Somebody got your job." And I took off. And that was around October of 71. And I stayed sober. I didn't pick up a drink all the way through the holidays. I didn't pick up a drink. I live in Yorkville, born and raised in Yorkville. I live in 86th Street. That's where the St. Patrick's Day parade breaks up. That's where generations of friends meet. And my nieces are coming from Westchester. And I remember the three of us walking up the street, and I had a camel hair coat and a Russian Cossack hat on with all sprigs of shamrocks on it. And my nieces were all dressed, and everybody's shaking my hands and taking pictures, and because it's a reunion day for all of us. And we got up there, and I'm yelling at the marchers, and they're passing the bottles around. The bottle came to me, and I pulled the plug, and I started drinking. And that drink led to 2 weeks of drinking I never knew existed. This time, the fears were so great that I never left the apartment. I had the windows locked, the shades drawn, the phone off the hook. The only phone calls I made was to the liquor store across the street to have the booze delivered in the morning. And for this two-week drunk, I was totally isolated. And only an alcoholic would understand that pure isolation. I loved it. I mean, the only friends and enemies I had was the furniture. I would stand in the middle of the room with my shoulders squared away, with my head up and the wind blowing through my hair. I'd stand there, a man amongst men, all things to women. Jackie and Nasser would be on their knees with their arms around my knees, holding me, saying, "I love you, Brian, please take the money. And I'd throw my head back and laugh and say, "Money? You can't buy a man like me with money." And I'd pick her up and I'd open the door and I'd throw her out. Next minute they'd be banging at the door and it'd be Sophia Loren. "Please, Brian, please. Just once. And I'd fight and I'd push her out and I'd lock the door and I'd yell through the door, "Why don't you women leave me alone? Can't you see I'm only human? Leave me alone." Or I'd stand in the middle of the room huffing and puffing because I had just knocked out Muhammad Ali for the heavyweight championship of the world. I was always knocking out this guy. And I would always knock him out March 16th so I could lead the St. Patrick's Day parade. And I'd see myself making that wide turn on Fifth Avenue, that final stretch before they come down 86th Street, and everybody would stop and perk up. And here I'd come with a little patch over my eye where he caught me with a lucky left hook. You know? And the cops would be in the horses, and the bands would really pick up. And all the cops would have their arms linked, trying to hold back the surging crowd of women. And they'd be knocking their hats off, and they'd say, "There's Brian, there's the champ, there's the champ." And every now and then I'd hear a cop say, "What a man." Or I'd be standing in the middle of the room, and I'd have a bottle, the bottle in my hand, and I'd be holding it up, and the tears would be running down my cheeks, and the hair would be mild and wild and matted from the drunk, and the vomity, dribbly old T-shirt, everything I drank and puked was all over. The only thing white on it was the sweat mark around the armpits, and I'd have these warm, wrinkled, farty shorts, and I'd be weaving back and forth, and the tears would be running down my eyes, because it was the third year in a row I had won the Academy Award. Well, anyway, April Fool's Day, April 1st, 1972, Intergroup finally came and they got me. And they carted me off to a detox. And I don't ever want to forget. I remember they were taking me down to see a detox at Freeport Hospital. And my brother-in-law had one arm, and the nurse had the other arm. And the hair was wild and matted from that two-week drunk, and had the two-week growth, and the vomity, dribbly old T-shirts, and naturally those warm, wrinkled, farty shorts. I mean, they went with me. If I got up, they got up. If I staggered in the street and fell, they staggered and fell in the street. And mark my words, ladies and gentlemen, one day shorts like that will have their own meetings, the ladies. And God knows they deserve it, too. And I had this old pea-stained pair of pants on, you know, with the fly broken, half open, half closed. So I never needed a belt. You just pull them off, kick them on, you pull them on. And the paint-stained pair of slippers, the right foot on the left and the left foot on the right. And this is the way they were taking me down. And as we got closer to the nurse's station, right opposite was the men's lounge. And through the corner of my eye, I could see this guy step out. And he saw the three of us coming down. And he stepped back and I could hear him say, "Hey, guys, come out and look at this guy, a real wolf man." And they came out and they saw me and they went, "Oh." And they started yelling at the nurse, "Don't touch him, nurse, you get locked jaw." And they all start laughing. Your fingers are right off, one day at a time, and they all start laughing. And I remember this one guy saying, "Nah, this guy's not real. He's an April Fool's Day. They're just trying to scare us." And this is the first time in my life, ladies and gentlemen, that a man or a woman ever laughed at me, and I couldn't do anything about it. I remember I was standing there, you know, with my head down, and you know how the voices go to work on you? And the voices kept saying, "Look at this, you rotten bastard. Look at this. Look at them laughing at you. You've been nothing but a disgrace all your life. For once in your life, try to be a man. For once, try to do something right. For once, get your head up. You've been nothing but trouble all your life. Get up. Get your head up, you human stink. Get it up." And I kept trying to get my head up to look at these people. But it seems like somebody had used a machete and cut up all my neck muscles and my back muscles. I just couldn't get my head up. And if there's one thing at that moment I wish I could have done, and that was to grab myself by the head of the hair, yank my face up, and spit right into it. That's how I felt about myself. It was the second day on my 38th birthday. I was physically bankrupt, mentally bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt, financially bankrupt, and sexually bankrupt. I see now in retrospect that I have been slipping in and out of intimacy since I was about 28 years old. Sexually, I was having a problem. And it was tough. I was a bartender and a sandhog and a seaman, and I'd be in a bar, and the guy would say, "Yeah, I took the girl home last night and made love two or three times." And this guy here, he took the girl home and he made love two or three times. And this guy here, he took the girl home and he made love two or three times. Well, I'm telling you now, what I see in sobriety, that if these guys were taking these girls home, making love two or three times, one thing is for sure, they weren't drinking what I was drinking, that's for sure. You don't drink that stuff and go home and make love two or three times. You go home and fall out of the bed. Maybe there's some guy out there that kind of knows what I'm talking about. As for the women, they know what I'm talking about. And I was in the bed, they had the sideboards up because every time that, you know, those nerves would hit, bang, I'd jolt and I'd be going out and they'd come in and pick me up and show me the bed, they had the sideboards. And I was laying there for about 2 days. I couldn't get out. I was that sick and dehydrated. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, I would say, and this vision of loveliness walked in. It was a nurse. She had long, sheen, black hair. She looked like she was about 28, maybe 30 years old. big eyes, big white eyes reflecting the foyer lights. And she sat on my bed, and I was still laying there with the party shorts and the dribbly T-shirt and the hair wild. And she sat on my bed. She started to talk in a cooing voice, saying to me, "I know what you're going through, Brian. I know what you're going through." And I was looking at this young lady, and she looked like she was born with a silver spoon in her mouth, that she never worked a day in her life, that this was all part of a gig, was to sit there and talk to people like me. And I just couldn't take this bold-faced hypocrisy. And I said, "Look, I know you mean well, but," I said, why don't you just get up and get the hell out of here and leave me alone?" I said, "I can beat this. I beat worse things than this. Just get out of here and leave me alone." And she got off the bed, and she said, "All right, Brian, I'll leave you alone." And she leaned over, and she said, "But don't you dare ever tell me I don't know what you're going through." She said, "Brian, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been in many a bed like this." Now, ladies and gentlemen, when she said to me that she was an alcoholic, it was like the fist of Gulliver slamming in the chest. If it wasn't for the bed springs, the impact of what she said to me would have driven me right through the springs to the deck. Never in a million years did I ever think there was such a thing as a female alcoholic. We didn't even use words like alcoholic referring to ourselves, bum and creep and philo and winos, but never an alcoholic. And I drank with women all over the world. I drank with them in penthouses, I drank with them in doorways, I drank with them in hallways and down in cellars, and I'd be sitting in the doorway with them, and I'd sit with them, and they'd have nothing on except an old house coat with the buttons broken open, their feet caked, their toes caked with black blood from walking the streets in search of a bottle. And never did I ever think of these women as alcoholics, because usually they were my friends' mothers or sisters or daughters or sweethearts. We never thought of them as an alcoholic. And when she said that she was an alcoholic, something broke through. Something broke through. I mean, it's a day at a time for years now. I'm still trying to figure out and still learning what broke through. But somehow, intuitively, I knew. I knew that the only thing that separated her and I was a drink. Because 2 weeks before that, walking up to that parade, I looked just like that woman. And I knew in my heart that if she picked up a drink, she would look just like me. And something got through. And they suggested 90 days, 90 minutes when I got out. And the greatest thing I had going for me was anger. I had this angry, angry drive never to pick up another drink. I'm one of these grateful alcoholics, ladies and gentlemen, that never had a white-knuckle sobriety. I've never wanted a drink since the day I left that hospital. Whatever it is, AA, whatever it is that alcohol gave me, it gave, and whatever it took, it took. I have no amends to make to it. There's no amends to make to me. I just don't pick up that first drink. And I came out, and I sat up in the front row, and I remember I would search out the old-timers, and I would ask them, "Why 90 days? Why 90 days, 90 meetings?" I said, "I mean, where did you come up with the concept? Why 90 days, 90 meetings?" And they would look at me, and they said, "I don't know. Nobody seemed to, but it was important to me, because it seemed like all my life I had been raised with these esoteric numbers, these mystical numbers, ever since I was a boy. First there was the 12 apostles, the 10 commandments, the 12 lost tribes of Israel, the nine planets, the seven deadly sins, the eight wonders of the world, the four winds, the seven seas. Moses was in the desert for 40 years. Columbus was on the Atlantic 40 days, 40 nights. And now me, 90 days, 90 minutes. But nobody seemed to know. Nobody seemed to know why it was 90 days, 90 minutes. But it didn't take me long to figure it out. And I came to the conclusion that you have to be here 90 days, 90 meetings just to understand what the hell they're talking about. Because there's a very sophisticated way of speaking in these rooms. You see, the topic would be, you see, by not making a decision, you made a decision. Oh, they go crazy. Oh, God. Oh, what a topic. What a topic, you know. You see, it is in not taking the action that you took the action. Oh, boy. Oh, Jesus. Sponsor. You're a circuit speaker with that one, believe me, you know. The one that always got me was, you see, you can't keep it unless you give it away. In fact, you have to give it away. The more you give, the more you get. You have to give it away. And I leaned over and said to my sponsor, "Joe, what the hell are they giving away? I mean, Joe, they don't work. They're all unemployed on welfare. Joe, they're on alimony. What the hell are they giving away?" And Joe said, "Look, just keep coming to the meetings. Shut up. Keep coming to the meetings." And it seems like in the first 90 days, I ran into the same cluster of speakers. It seemed no matter where I went, I was running into the same speakers. And it seems like each one had a little gimmick that they were selling. So I'd sit there and nickname the speakers. And I'd have nicknames like, "Here comes little Mary Bliss.
That's easy, does it, Ed? Uh-oh, here's first things first, Joe. I had all these nicknames. And this speaker got up and he introduced him, and his name was Charlie. And Charlie went into a store and he said, I picked up a drink, I fell down a flight of stairs, and I surrendered. And they all started to applaud and hug him and kiss him and get his autograph and invite him to parties. I sat there stunned. I mean, I fell off gangways, garbage cans, bar stools. And never in a million years would I ever tell a shit story like that in public. I mean, especially not in front of the girls, you know? I remember saying to myself, this guy will never get a girl with a story like that, you know? And about a week, I immediately nicknamed him Staircase Charlie. About a week later, they introduced Staircase Charlie again. I said, oh, there's Staircase. And I got up front and I sat there and I zeroed right in on the story because it was very important to me to find out what kind of a staircase it was that made him surrender. Now, I could see if he says he picked up a drink and he fell down a four-story spiral staircase. All right, you go four stories down a spiral staircase. I can see you rolling over in that one. Or maybe he's going to say he picked up a drink and he fell five stories between the banisters. Well, I can see you rolling over in that one. But somehow the way he stood and the way he talked and the way he was dressed, I knew in my heart that this guy was strictly a two-step foyer job, you know? And he went into a story and he said, I picked up a drink, I fell down a flight of stairs, and I surrendered. And they all started to applaud and hug him and kiss him and get his autograph and invite him to parties. And I sat there and I said to myself, why don't this guy tell a real story? Nobody, not even a kid, picks up a drink, falls down a flight of stairs and surrenders. Why don't he tell him the real story? He had a drink, he was drunk. That's why I fell down a flight of stairs. You see, they kept pumping into me, Brian, keep bringing the body, keep bringing the body. Sooner or later, the head will follow. And here it was, a week later, I'd heard the same story, but this time I heard it just a little bit different. And they introduced this guy about 2 weeks later. This is the third time in a month I'm listening to this guy. I knew his story by heart. And I'm sitting there, and as he got into his story, as he got close to picking up that first drink, I felt my stomach tighten. I said, watch that drink, Charlie. And he got closer and closer. I said, Charlie, can't you see what you're doing? Watch the drink, Charlie. And Charlie said, and I picked up a drink, and I said, oh, well, grease the banisters. There goes Charlie. I know in my heart of hearts, ladies and gentlemen, that once Charlie picked up that drink, no way in hell could he beat the staircase. I mean, I lay odds from here to Vegas. I just knew he was going down that flight of stairs. It was the first time I fully identified with the first drink. And not only that, but I could see all the contributing factors that Charlie led up to picking up that drink. He never got involved, didn't make meetings, got there late, left early, didn't get a sponsor, didn't get involved. I could see the things that led up to him picking up that drink. And it sort of opened up the first drink concept for me. And I kept coming to the meetings, and as the anger diminished, I could hear things a little bit different and see things a little bit different. But I stayed away from the closed meetings because of the concept of God. I'd walked away at God at 14, and nobody, including you, was about to ram God down my throat. But I happened to be at a beginner's meeting when it went into the concept of God. And one said it was this, another said it was this, another said it was this. And I remember this kid raising his hand saying, the way he had heard God was G-O-D, good orderly direction. God, G-O-D, good orderly direction. Speaking for myself, ladies and gentlemen, when I heard that good orderly direction, it was like a hole was blown in my chest. Centuries of venom and stink poured out. For here now was a God that I could understand was good orderly direction. As far as I was concerned, that's what God was supposed to have been all along, was good orderly direction. But somehow the way I was born and raised and it was presented, I just couldn't take it. But this I could. And I remember leaning back, relaxing, looking behind the speaker, and the slogans was there. And it had first things first, keep it simple, let go, and let good orderly direction. And I literally turned my will and my life over to care of a good orderly direction, which was you, AA. And all you were asking of me then was to try to stay away from a drink, try to do the best that I can, try to get to a meeting. And everything became good orderly direction. But it wasn't so much that it was a concept of God, because Joe and the rest of you told me, Brian, don't worry about God. If you pick up a drink, they won't be sending God back to the detox. It's you and that first drink. Remember that, Brian. But the word that got me was the word direction. All my life, ladies and gentlemen, I had been looking for some type of direction. I'd be a liar if I stood up here and told you all I ever did was drink and carouse around. That wasn't me at all, ladies and gentlemen. I was always trying to be a man. I was always trying to be a man. I was always trying to do the right thing. I was always shining my shoes, trying to put my best foot forward. I was always washing my face, combing my hair, trying to make that first good, long-lasting impression. I was always saying I'm sorry. I was always paying back my bills. I was always trying to make amends. I was always an alcoholic, ladies and gentlemen. I was always picking up a drink. And I was always and always and always. And here I was sitting in a room full of alcoholics offering me good old direction in my life. Ladies and gentlemen, I may have been everybody's drunk, but I assure you I was never anybody's fool. I knew right then and there that if I didn't make it in this room, in a room full of alcoholics with you, I wasn't going to make it. I just knew it. And I just lapped it right up. Everything in my life became good orderly direction. I go up to the job, I see two guys punching it out in the hog house. I see a guy getting fired, I see them getting fired. I walk down the street, I see a guy pulling a woman out of the cab by the hair of the head, dragging her back into the bar because he hasn't finished drinking yet. I see some guy puking between two cars. I see some guy trying to balance himself with one hand as he pees all over himself with the other hand. I see some guy bumming on the corner trying to get money into a bar, to get into the bar. I see that guy sitting vacantly staring out at the bar, vacantly staring out at life passing him by, a life he has very little to do or say about as long as he continues drinking. And I say to myself, there but for the grace of good orderly direction goes I. And it made all the sense in the world, ladies and gentlemen, because I no longer did any of that. Because I trusted in you. And all you asked of me was to try to stay away from a drink, try to do the best that I can, try to get to a meeting, try to help another alcoholic. And everything became good all the direction. And I kept coming to the meetings, and I kept coming to the meetings, and I was always active, always involved. And I remember I was having lunch with my mother one day, and over on the dresser, she had one of these birds. You ever see the birds? You put the beak in the water, and it goes up, and it keeps going up and down, up in the water. And I'm having lunch, and I'm looking over there, and the bird is going up and down. I felt like getting up and slapping it off the dresser. And I said to my mother, I said, Mom, I said, what kind of bird is that? And she said, Dad, she said, I don't know, some kind of a novelty bird. I said, no, Mom, please, it's important to me. What kind of a bird is that? And she says, I don't know, a dodo bird. And I said, that's it, the dodo bird. I vowed then and there never to become an AA dodo bird. I used to hate the AA dodo birds. I'd be sitting at the meeting, and the speaker would say something like, I took my sponsor's advice, and I went to the bank president, and I just explained I don't have the money at this time. I just don't have the money. And it was all right. It was all right. And all of a sudden, I see the dodo birds go, they all saw none, you know. But the speaker would say, for the first time in my life, I leaned over the subway platform, to lean to see if the train was coming. And it was all right. And they'd all look at each other, and, oh yeah, they're all going to nod. I say, Joe, what the hell are they nodding about? He says, they're identifying with feelings. Now, where I come from, believe me, nobody ever spoke about feelings. There were four or five ways that you said that completely covered the gamut of emotions or feelings. And in order to get your point across, you merely raise or lower your voice. Somebody said, how are you? I said, good, pretty good, pretty bad, 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 pretty good. You just, you know, I mean, if you said anything more, you're a bullshitter. You said anything less, you're a crybaby. You know, so you hung in the center there. Just raise or lower your voice. But I was at a meeting, and I remember this lady. She came from Queens, and she had red hair, glasses, a broken nose, and she was married. That's the only thing I remember about her. And right in the middle of the qualification, I caught myself nodding like a mule. Man, I was pumping up and down. And it was like a great discovery. I mean, here was a woman that opened up the whole world of discovery to me, the whole world of identification. I mean, it is through her that today I can say, ladies and gentlemen, I may never see you again. But when somebody tells me that they're an alcoholic, I know you. It indeed is the language of the heart. I know you, ladies and gentlemen. I may never see her again or you, but I know. I know your fears and your fantasies and your aspirations. I know you, an alcoholic, linking with the bonding of another alcoholic. And I immediately nicknamed AA the Land of Nod, you know, and I'd be hustling down a bar, and the guy would see me, hey, Brian, where you going? Only $5, where you? And I'd peel out the $5. He'd say, where you going? I say, I'm going to Land of Nod, you know. He said, what's that, a new bar? A new bar or what? And I say, don't worry about it. You spend the $5. You'll be there soon enough. Come on. I'll see you. Yeah. And things really started clicking, ladies and gentlemen. I was about a year sober, and I was working a 4 to 12 up in Van Cortlandt Park. It was a dynamite on the job. And usually I'd get up and early in the morning, and around 12 o'clock, I'd have breakfast. And then right outside an 86th Street, outside Barney Google's, a nightclub, I would sit there and have lunch. And this day I was sitting there, and I had a cup of coffee in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand. and just watching the people go by. And all of a sudden, this little girl came running up the street. And she looked like a little Shirley Temple, little hairs tousling, little curls in her hair, and dimples and kneecaps. And she came running up, and she came plopping on my lap with this big lollipop. And she stuck it on this lollipop, and she pulled it out, and she kept pushing the lollipop toward me. I'm looking down at this here kid. She's pushing a lollipop. And the mother came up, and the mother said to me, "She wants you to lick the lollipop." And I took the lollipop, and I put it in my mouth, and I took a big slurp, and I gave it back to her. And she jumping up and down with the curls bouncing, popped it in her mouth. And she started skipping up the street. And the mother looked at me and nodded, and I looked at the mother and nodded. And the two of them started walking up the block, and I was looking at them going. And all of a sudden, this tremendous feeling of love overcame me. This tremendous feeling just started pouring off my shoulders. And it was the first time in my life I had ever experienced something like that. And I just didn't know what it was. And I said, "This is good all the direction." Because up until I heard that, everything was good all the direction. I said, "This is good all the direction." But for the first time since I heard those words, good all the direction, the feelings didn't quite fit. And I said, "No, this isn't good all the direction. This is the God of the rooms. This is the God they've been talking about. This is the God of sobriety. This is the God of sobriety." And I was just blown away by it. I leaned back, "The God of sobriety." I said, "God, God bless you, God." Like I went over his head to his boss or something. I mean, you know, what the hell do I know about God, you know? And things really started clicking, ladies and gentlemen. And I was about 4 years sober when I got a phone call from California saying that they were taking out of Bath, Maine, the bicentennial ship, and would I like to be part of the crew. And I agreed. It was a great honor. And I had about 2 weeks to go before they flew the crew up. And about a week before we left, a friend of mine, Roy, his sponsor, another guy, was going to pick him up at 7 o'clock in the morning to take him to a detox. He was on a drunk. And whatever went through Roy's head or his mind, I don't know. But before they got there, he opened the window and he dove out 27 stories. And when he got there, it was a mess. He had 5 kids, a wife. The cops were there, the ambulance. It was a mess. And Roy was half Jewish and half Irish Catholic, and his mother flew in from San Francisco, and they had him cremated, and it was a big fight, and it was ugly at the memorial, and it was nasty, bickering back and forth with the family. And Roy had been a seaman at one time, and I had gotten together with his sponsor and the family, and we sat him down, and they explained that I'll be leaving in about a week, and why not give the ashes to Brian, and Brian will have him buried at sea. And he agreed to that. So we got the ship sailed in the Atlantic, and I went to see the captain. The captain told me he couldn't do it, that in order to bury a person at sea as an official burial, entered in the logbook, that it'd have to be, you need the death certificate. So when I got to Panama, I called up and told him to fly me the death certificate to San Francisco. And when the ship sailed in San Francisco, before I left, I picked up 5 roses, 5 red ones, one for each one of the kids, and a long stem rose for his wife. And the captain asked me, "Where would you like them buried? When do you want to hold a burial?" And I said, "I'd like to have them buried on the international dateline." Somehow I just liked the idea that one of us officially would be buried on the international dateline by one of us. I just liked the idea, and he agreed. And the date came, and you could feel the ship shuddering as it started to slow down, the smoke pouring out of the stack, and the telegraphs ringing, you could hear it. And all of a sudden, the passengers came out, the crew came out, the cadets came out and had the plank with the flag. They put the ashes and the flag over it, and they put the, and before I put all of the roses together, I stapled them to that small plastic serenity prayer card we had. And they held the service and they dumped it over and made sure it was closed with the Our Father. And as I watched the flowers being sucked into the wake of the ship, I couldn't help but think that whatever went through Roy's head, he was drunk and alone when he committed suicide. But he was buried with AA dignity. He was buried by AA fellowship, AA dignity. And that's the one thing we hear, ladies and gentlemen. We hear that the eyes are the windows of the soul. And I think that that's what the newcomers see when they come in. They see the hope in our eyes. But what they don't see is the silent dignity being held in that outstretched hand. And that's what we had. That's what we offered this man. We offered him dignity. And I went up and I got the longitude and latitude from the logbook. I had some photographs taken. And when I got to Yokohama, I mailed it to his wife. So this way, she or the kids, at any time they want, they can go to a map and trace out the longitude and trace out the latitude and say, "This is where my father is buried." And in times, I'm sure they'll say, "This is where my grandfather was buried," and say it with dignity. That's what we give each other. We dignify one another. The ship sailed on. Before I left, I had registered with GSO as an internationalist. And they had given me a list of all the people and loners and all over the world. And there was one port that I pulled in, and there was a missionary, a priest, that was way up in the hills of Taiwan somewhere. And I started to correspond with him. And he said, "Brian, if you ever get here and you get a chance," he said, "I'd like to take my fifth step with you." He had been sober 5 years, and he had never told a story to another human being. It was all done through letters and tapes. And I agreed. And there was a couple of times getting in there before I had a chance to get up there. And finally we got there, and I rented a car and a driver, and we went clippity-clap over the hills and dills and rice paddies. And I finally got into the inland to this small missionary that he ran, an orphanage. And I spent the whole day with him, taking his fifth step. And I'd see his eyes rolling in retrospect, and he'd go into long tangents of Chinese, and then he'd weave back into English and in and out of Chinese. And I looked at him, and I realized how lucky I was to have sobered up in New York. Because with a sponsor. Because what this man was telling me had nothing to do with what was written on the paper. You take the fifth step, to sober up, the importance of a sponsor, that because what you think up here and what you feel here, but what you're saying here is two different things. Because what this man was telling me wasn't at all with what he had written on the paper. And I realized how lucky I had been to sober up in the United States, but I realized how blessed he was to have sobered up with the help of GSO, with the help of people who take time to correspond and send tapes all over the world. And I came back, and with the help of the people in the program, they got me into Fordham University, going 5.5 days, going 3 days a week to night school and working 5.5 years. In 1982, I graduated from Fordham University with a degree in fine art. And I did a lot of things, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of things that I'm proud of and a lot of things that I'm ashamed of. And one of the most things that I was deeply ashamed of all my life was the fact that I didn't know how to drive. I was just fearful of driving, paranoid. I was deeply ashamed. I'd be all over the world and somebody would want a car or me to drive the car, and I was petrified of driving. And this is a young lady who I knew. She too didn't have a license, and she went and she got a license, and this day she came up to my apartment, knocked at the door, she came in, showed me her license, and she literally took me by the hand. And we walked up a few blocks to the driver's school, and she had me registered. And I took the full amount, whatever it was, 10 or 15 driving, that's what I took. And at the end of the evening, I would drive up to Yonkers Raceway with this guy and drive back. And the group, they would know when I came in, when I had a driver's license, because I'd walk in, a driving lesson, because they would know I look like a Michelin man. I'd come in, I'd be all locked up from tension. I'd come walking in. And people would take me in the car, and they would patiently help me along with it. And the day came when I had to take the test, and the instructor with the car went down. I took the test, and a couple of weeks later, I'd come home from work, and there was this here letter from the motor vehicles. And the heart started to pound, and the ice cold sweat running down my arms. And I went up and I locked the door and I put it there and I got a towel out. And I opened it up and I read, there was my driver's license. And the tears just bubbled up and I put my face in the towel so nobody would hear me crying. And it just poured out of me. I had a driver's license. Me, Brian Mines, had a driver's license. And I had it about 6 months. And whatever it was, ladies and gentlemen, one day I just got up quietly and made a cup of tea for myself, got dressed, I walked up to Avis, I rented out a car, and my biggest sober fantasy in all my life was to drive to a diner, walk in, sit on a stool, and order up a cup of coffee. I had seen that on movies all throughout the years. I saw it on television. I read about it in books. I saw the cowboy where he would drive up, and go in the batwing doors and order a drink. And I'd see the cowboy, the guy with the motorcycle. But to do it with the car, and it had to be a diner. And the only diner I knew was out in Rockaway. That's the only one. So I got in the car, and I drove out and over the bridge, and they're beeping the horn, and I'm just looking straight ahead going there, and I had to make a right here, and I made it, and I finally pulled up, and I parked the car, and I got up, and I walked in, and I sat on a stool, and I ordered up a cup of coffee, and ladies and gentlemen, to this day, that was the finest day of my life. Amen. Ladies and gentlemen, they don't come much better than that, believe me. They don't come much better than that. I got in the car, and I drove back, and I paid out. I paid the Avis, and I was walking down the street, and you could hear the water in my shoes squishing.
and I was all locked up. And that was in 1986, ladies and gentlemen. And to this day, I still don't drive. The hell with that shit, let me tell you that, man. Steve picked me up at the airport. He got me here safe and sound. Steve is going to pick me up here, get me back to the airport safe and sound, and that's good enough for me, believe me. And as I'm 56 years old, ladies and gentlemen, I'm 18 years sober, there's a lot of things I did. There's a lot of things, and if I wish I could stand here today and tell you, here I am, fully potentiated, here I am. I hit my potential. I'm really on a roll. But the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. That's the truth. But I found out in this program, ladies and gentlemen, that it's not really that important to know who you are. What is important is to know who you are not. I am not that young man the FBI took off in Mobile, Alabama in handcuffs and had to stand trial for near beating a man to death. I'm not that man the FBI took off in New York and had to stand trial for mutiny. I'm not that man dragging that woman out of the cab at 3 o'clock in the morning, dragging her into a bar because he hasn't finished drinking. I'm not that man puking between two cars. I'm not that man peeing up against the wall. I'm not that dirty old young man being shuffled into a detox. And I'm not that old man or that young man vacantly staring out of a bar. I am not a lot of things today, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks to you and this wonderful program. I am not a lot of things. And somehow by seeing the many things that I am not, somehow I begin to see the many things that I am. And on those rare occasions when I do have the courage and the wisdom to look, I see the many things I can yet become. If I continue to adhere to the principles of this program, if I continue staying away from that first drink, if I continue reaching out to the suffering alcoholic. I was in San Francisco a few years ago when I heard a lady say something that completely blew me away. The spiritual simplicity of what she said took all of this, all of this, and reduced it to its lowest denominator when she said, "By no means does AA open the gates of heaven and let me in, but they sure open the gates of hell and let me out." Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank each and every one of you for opening those gates and for letting me out. On my bended knees, I thank the Almighty God for each and every one of you. And on my other knee, I thank each and every one of you for me. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for me.